A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on August 20, 1989, in the series Human Transformation, the Gospel and AA, entitled Nobody's Perfect, Learning to Live with Our Limits. The scripture reading is Romans 12. The text for the sermon is Romans 12, verse 2. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Well, nobody's perfect. I suppose you've said that a time or two. Probably when you messed up mildly and just sort of threw your hands up and grinned and said, well, nobody's perfect. You might have said that when you messed up somewhat less than mildly, and there were some rather condemning eyes around. And then you would say it with a bit more fervor, well, nobody's perfect. And maybe you've said it when someone for whom you cared and for whom you felt rather protective was being attacked, and you reminded everybody that nobody's perfect. Well, really, no one would argue with that. It's kind of universally accepted. It's sort of a truism. In fact, even though the day isn't very nice, all of you did come to church. And in this rare moment before the Word of God, why would the preacher make a point of something so mundane that is universally accepted and hardly controverted that nobody's perfect? Well, I have my reasons, and we'll get to that. But I do want to acknowledge, to begin with, that we all know that nobody's perfect. But you might not ever, at least in church, have the permission to rest in that fact that nobody's perfect. You might not ever in church feel the warm arms of community around you looking you in the face of your failure, saying to you genuinely, nobody's perfect. In other words, don't be so hard on yourself. Nobody's perfect. Now let's move on. Well, what kind of a message have we given in the church? Well, we've certainly given a message that nobody's perfect. I mean, if you didn't catch it, the church has often used the two before and clobbered you over the head with it. Nobody's perfect. In fact, ain't many of you much good at all. And one of the most significant control items in the church's artillery is this matter of convincing people of their unworthiness and their constant sinfulness, which keeps them coming back to the trough of grace and forgiveness. So, I can't really say that the church has not acknowledged that nobody's perfect. But I'm trying to get at something, because somehow or other, the fact that nobody's perfect, and that's known in the church, has never been able to set me free to acknowledge in the church that I'm not really perfect. I mean, I know I'm not really perfect. I know that I'm a bundle of contradictions. I know that I'm really a mixed bag. I know that there are moments of absolute nobility when I will the best and the highest. And I know that within 10 seconds, I can have the most dastardly designs and all of that coexisting in one little warm, palpitating, beating human heart. I'm full of contradictions. Light and shadow. Nobility, misery. Victories, defeats. It's all here. It's all in me. And I'm aware of it all. Well, not all. There's a lot that I'm not aware of, and that's why I do such silly things that I don't understand. But I don't really dare admit that in church. I mean, I wouldn't admit that if I wasn't exposed on the stool. Because in church, we've said nobody's perfect. But we've also laid on people what I would like to call, not a phrase I've coined, but a phrase I adopt, the tyranny of the ought, the should, and the must. I must, I should, I ought. I must, I should, I ought. What else have you learned in church all your years except that you ought, you must, and you should? And of course, all the things that you ought and you must and you should, you really must, ought, and should. They're good. And that's really what you ought to be about. Somehow or other, you come to church and that gets laid on you. The kind of sanctified atmosphere in this holy setting from this righteous man. And you really affirm that too, but you know something else. You know that you are a bundle of contradictions just like I am. And there are some people who find that such an excruciatingly painful conflict that they drop out of church. They drop out of church because they agree, they should, they must, they ought. But they can't, they won't, they never will. And so they think this bag is not for them. Those of us that are left must be we got it all together. I mean, we come here nicely dressed. We've used right guard. And we give this visage of having it all together and control. How are you today? Just fine. How are you? And this is not exactly the place where you want to take off your clothes. This is a place where you kind of want to keep the mask intact, keep the garments closely wound around you, and if there is some appearance of respectability and control, then for God's sake, keep it intact here. Am I right? I think I'm right. I've been in the church for nearly 100 years now. We know nobody's perfect, but we've kind of said, but you ought to be perfect. You must, you ought, you should. And the conflict within can be very painful, and if I don't drop out because it's just plain too painful, what I really do is sort of despise myself. I mean, if you can stay in church all your life and never face honestly who you really are and keep up that charade all your life, I guarantee you, you don't like yourself very well. And when you come to church, it's a reinforcement of all the negative stuff you feel about yourself, because there's nobody harder on you than you. Now, in steps 6 and 7, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. In step 7, humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings. What the person going through the program comes to is the point of saying, step 4, searching, fearless, moral inventory, that's the story. I own the story before God, myself, and another human being. And then I say, I want my life to change. I don't want a bang, transformation, instantaneous, new look. But I want to begin where I am, systematically, purposefully, intentionally, to have my life transformed into a life that reflects the purpose of God in the first place. I am ready, Lord. Move into my life with the power of your Spirit, and by your grace begin to chip away, to rub down the rough edges, and to build into me that character which I affirm and which I yearn to have realized in my being, because I know that that is precisely the living out of your intention and the realization of the highest potential. Steps 6 and 7. Put the recovering person into converse with God and begin a daily trip, which is a constant working at one's character without despair, without pride, with a humility that has accepted oneself just as one is. Humility is really the keystone of every one of these steps, and it is here that one humbly acknowledges where one is and where one would like to be going and moving by the grace of God. Humility is not groveling in the sand and saying, what a worm am I? Humility isn't humiliation, stripping the dignity of the human person, putting people down. Humility is just an honest facing of oneself according to the best self-knowledge that one can attain, in the honest interaction with community and before the face of God. Humility says, I've got some wonderful strengths. I've got some horrible weaknesses. I've got a shining side, and I've got a shadow side. I am a mixed bag, and often a mystery to myself. But by God, this is who I am before the face of God. And by God's grace, this is the kind of person, more and more, I'd like to become. I often say that the recovering person is such a lucky person, because life's circumstances have brought one to a crisis which necessitated the engagement with oneself and some such process. Those of us who have been blessed with a kind of balanced life, who are able to keep the garments wrapped around us and the mask in place, but who here be perfect and know we're not perfect and struggle with a contradiction within, we may be able to carry it off, but at the expenditure of tremendous psychic energy, knowing no spontaneity and genuine freedom in our human experience. No, the person who is brought face to face, an in-depth look into the mirror, and then can begin by God's grace before the face of God to be shaped after the image of Jesus Christ, that person is a fortunate person indeed. And in the AA program, that is accomplished without condemnation, without judgmental attitudes, without barriers going up, without the body language of rejection. It is simply an honest ascertainment of where one is and a humble seeking to move toward wholeness and full humanity. And that, I think, is really what the Christian faith is all about. Freud was really pessimistic about human nature. If you want to be honest about it, Freud didn't give much hope for the possibility of affecting much change in human persons. I mean, he had that deep unconscious which in infancy was often distorted and warped through experience and through the rest of life caused all kinds of distortions. Freud was really pessimistic about the human person. A little analysis, a little knowledge, a little relief, but no essential change. Karl Marx was a little more optimistic, but he was naive in another way. He thought it's not an internal matter, but it's an external matter. Change the environment and you change the person. Historical determinism or economic determinism. History, the forces of history playing on the individual, make the individual, and all the conflicts that he manifests. He said, move toward utopia, toward the classless society, get rid of all the nasty capitalists. And then we'll have the human person. Perfect. Well, I think he's rolling over in his grave right now with what's happening in Poland. He was more right than he knew. It is economic determinism. It is the bottom line. They're out of money. Makes one open to God and capitalism. That was a pretty good line. But the Bible is optimistic. Some years ago, Carl Menninger, the great psychologist, wrote a book, Whatever Became of Sin, in which he pled with preachers to preach sin. He said it's the most humane thing you can do to your people. Because what you're saying to your people is, you can be different than you are. God intended you for more than you are. He said, hold people accountable. Speak to their responsibility. Hold before them their freedom, the possibility by the grace of God of life-changing, life-transforming experience. The Bible is optimistic. It's too bad that Genesis 3, that marvelously profound myth of human beginnings, is called the fall. It sounds like an awful thing, but it's not an awful thing. Genesis 3 is the great declaration of the possibility of a God who won't give up on his erring, aberrant creature, but will finally take him by the nape of the neck, hold him to his breast, love him, grace him, and make him what he intended him to be in the first place. Bible is neither moralizing on the human person, nor is it pessimistic about human possibility. It says, man and woman, stand up. You're a creature of God, created in the image of God, and there is potential in you that you haven't yet dreamed of. Paul, after writing this wonderful letter of Romans, comes to his final section, and he says, I plead with you by the mercy of God. You get that? Not by the law of God or the threat of God or the fear of God, but by the mercy of God. By the grace of God. Present your bodies, your whole being, a living sacrifice, which is intelligent worship. And don't let the world squeeze you into its form, its shape. But be transformed by the renewing of your mind so that you may prove the will of God, that which is holy and good and perfect. Metanoia is the Greek word, and it means literally to change your mind, to be renewed in mind, to get your thinking right. God's intention for us by God's grace is that we not live trapped in Freudian pessimism or Marxian utopianism, but in biblical optimism about the possibilities created by grace that can change us by grace. So, dear friends, nobody's perfect, and that's all right. And you can quote me. You can admit it anywhere you want to out there. You heard it in a service of Christian worship. Nobody's perfect, and that's all right. I struggle with these things, and I always think about it in terms of my own experience, and I don't know. It's hard to tell whether I'm preaching or telling the truth, I know, but as I was thinking about this, I thought about my own experience. My father invented the slogan, you can't do better than all A's. So when I was in grade school and I'd come home and it was a B plus, he would always suggest not too subtly that that could become an A minus, and the A minus could become an A. And we always saw the possibility before the last marking period was there of making that report card perfect. Now, I had all kinds of love, and he was so proud of me that, I mean, I don't think I'm coming off as suffering from a father complex. I mean, so proud I was embarrassed, and so much love I couldn't hold it. But also that drive toward perfection. So in the ninth grade, when I learned that there were two terms, there was a salutatorian and a valedictorian. Salutatorian would not have been good enough. Sorry to all you salutatorians out there, but number two is not good enough. And then in high school, of course, there's honors and there's high honors, and honors, not good enough. And in college, I mean, it's cum laude, magna cum laude, and summa cum laude, and nothing but the summit would be the summit of attainment. All my life. So that today, I still cannot accept a wart with good humor. I fall on my face on Sunday morning, please don't talk to me about it until about Wednesday. And I'm pretty smart. I got all this down. I talk to myself. I say, self, so you didn't do so well. You can't always do so well. Don't be so hard on yourself. Okay. The head's got it, the tummy hasn't. Depression, in a funk, don't like myself, then depressed because I'm depressed. The whole syndrome. I wonder if I could have been Suma without my dad's pressure. I wonder if there were other things. For example, maybe if I hadn't had to have high honors, which meant I couldn't afford very many B's, I could have taken typing in high school. It was a manual skill, and I wasn't sure I could do a manual skill and get an A. So I took a hard academic course, which I knew I could master. So I can't type to this day. So I got this big writer's bump. And several secretaries have committed suicide. Well, I just think about these things myself. I don't know. I said to one of my children one day, when he was telling me about all the tremendous, world-shaking things he was doing, I said, "Do you know that I would love you if you didn't do anything?" Or maybe it's in the genes, I don't know. But I want to say to you this morning, you're not perfect, and that's okay. You're not perfect. Nobody's perfect. We're all limited. And you know, some of us are going to drag our wounded, broken psyches right into the presence of God Himself. We're never really going to make it. And that's okay. So, rest in grace. And just a day at a time, let grace do its shaping work, because there's coming a day when we will be conformed to the very image of Jesus by God's grace. So, take thou our minds, dear Lord.